Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you Foundations in Faith. Join Monsignor Frank Lane as he offers insights into the readings heard at Mass. And now, Foundations in Faith with Monsignor Frank Lane.
This is Father Frank Lane, and we're continuing our program, Foundations in Faith. We're going to look at the Gospel today, a reading from the Holy Gospel according to St. Matthew, the 5th chapter, the 13th to the 16th verse. And it is a gospel, once again, very familiar to us. Jesus said to his disciples, "You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt becomes tasteless, what can make it salty again? It is good for nothing and can only be thrown out to be trampled underfoot by men." First of all, this idea is always kind of perplexing in a way. How does salt lose its saltiness? In the early Palestinian world in which Jesus lived, salt was not well refined, and it was often filled with ground up other minerals as well. And if, in fact, it was left to where there was any moisture, or oftentimes just simply from the makeup of it itself, that the salt kind of dissipated, and what was left was a sort of very refined gravel, which had no capacity whatsoever to preserve food or to enhance the taste of food. So what, in fact, Jesus is referring to here is kind of interesting. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt becomes tasteless, what can make it salty again? This is something about, too, discipleship in this. And according to the commentaries, this is part of the witness story of Matthew. And so he's talking about the impact of being Christian in the midst of the world. If, in fact, we have allowed our faith to turn to gravel, we really have nothing actually to offer to the world. And there is no way to revitalize it or to bring it back again, except, of course, new salt. So he says it's good for nothing and can only be thrown out to be trampled underfoot by men. The same is true, therefore, of a faith which is not alive, a faith which is not active, a faith which does not really infuse our bodies, stir our hearts and our minds, and lead us to live witness lives within the world. I think we have to be careful with that also, because we can often think of living witness lives in the world, which means we must be somehow or other evangelically active in the world in which we live. It's something interpreted very often by evangelical Christians, that if you're not, you know, hypothetically, or knocking on doors, or standing on street corners somehow or other, you're not really living your faith. And that's not exactly what Jesus means at all. We know that in his own life, he himself did not do that. He himself depended on the power of who he was as a person and his relationship with the Father to draw people to him from all walks of life and in from every nook and cranny of Palestine, of the peoples of Israel. So that the salt then becomes a preservative, and the salt also enhances the flavor. The witness, therefore, for Matthew is that our faith is a witness by the light that is within us and by our effectiveness to, we might say, flavor or influence the world around us, in our families, in our local communities, in our workplace, and so forth. I think it was that every age, of course, is acceptable to another form of witness. And in some days, a demonstrative witness to the faith was very effective. In other times, it is, in a way, quieter and more personal and more local. We certainly find that in the ages when the church was very much an incredibly integrated part of Western society, its demonstrativeness was to be seen everywhere. But when, in fact, in the early church, that it was a persecuted minority, their life was more was quieter, and their life was more a quiet personal witness within the communities of which they lived, in which they supported one another and showed this support through their lives together to the outside world. We find even in the writings, I believe it's of Justin Martyr telling about the Christian community in the Roman Empire, and saying how in many ways they're indistinguishable from the rest of the people with whom they live, and yet at the same time they preserve their practices and their faith dispositions within the midst of that community. They do not set themselves off, he says, in any kind of way, but they do, in fact, have a profound influence on the world in which they live. And it comes to mind, too, in a very, I suppose, in a very tragic sort of way, that even in early Rome during the days of Nero, the Christians were very identifiable. They were not a powerful moving force within the secular civic society of Rome. And as a matter of fact, there was only moderate outcry when Nero burned their part of the city to the ground in order to clear the building, to clear the area of building so he could build the Circus Maximus. And one of the critics of what Nero did was Tacitus. And Tacitus, who had no use for the Christians, he considered them to be what he said, haters of humanity, which was a euphemism for cannibals, because he had heard of the body and the blood of the Lord and believed without knowing what that meant, that it was a form of cannibalism that they practiced. And so he says, although they deserved to die, what Nero did was wrong. And it was kind of like, you know, a pox on both their houses. But he nevertheless gave testimony and witness to the powerful understanding of the Eucharist within the Christian community. So it gave witness, even though it was not an aggressively in an active presence within the city of Rome. The gospel then goes on, "You are the light of the world. A city built on a hilltop cannot be hidden. No one lights a lamp to put it under a tub. They put it on the lampstand where it shines for everyone in the house. In the same way, your light must shine in the sight of men, so that seeing your good works, they may give the praise to your Father in heaven." Again, now we have already discussed then the role of salt as kind of flavoring the faith, of kind of preserving the faith in the midst of the world as a form of witness in Matthew's gospel. And now we look at the light of the world, and we have the familiar, the city built on a hill, something the Puritans identified with the settlements of New England in the 17th century. That somehow or other, as Puritan refugees from the English persecution and the English civil wars and so forth, they arrived in the New World and established their godly kingdom. Very oftentimes it said, well, this was a theocracy, meaning, you know, the ministers ruled it. That was not exactly true. The ministers did not necessarily rule it, but the elect ruled it. In other words, those who felt they were saved, those who were considered by their behavior within the Puritan society to be saved, were the ones who were entitled to rule. This was true in Calvin's Geneva, and as Calvinism spread then and became deeply embedded in England, although with cultural changes from some kind of a local city council governance to a kingdom ruled over by a king. It even caused the English Civil War, which lasted from around 1621 to around 1661. And it was a bloody episode, and an episode the origins of which had caused the pilgrims, the Puritans, to flee to the Low Countries and from there to come to New England. Most people with a ancestry or genetic tracing back to the Mayflower, back to the early settlers and so forth, when they go back a few generations from that, they'll find they are intermixed in some way with Low Country names also. So that what they built when they came when they came to the New World, the city on a hill, and this is exactly the gospel they were referring to. They were supposed to be a light to the nations. They were supposed to be the godly kingdom, the righteous kingdom, and so forth. Not exactly an adequate interpretation of the gospel, but certainly a phrase that becomes important to us in the story of American history. So the city built on a hilltop cannot be hidden, and that was the whole point. You are the light of the world. This was the Puritans' understanding of their city built on a hill, that it was to be a light of the world, an example of righteousness to the rest of the world. How that worked out was quite another story, I suppose. So, and then the gospel goes on to say, no one lights a lamp to put it under a bushel basket, or here it says a tub. They put it on a lampstand where it shines for everyone in the house. A reference to the ordinary living of the Palestinian people in the time of Jesus. The light in their house was basically an oil lamp, a single oil lamp, usually sometimes just simply like a saucer with oil poured in it and a floating wick on top of it. That certainly was not, you know, high-powered illumination, and so if they were going to light up the house with it, then it was to be in kind of a high place in the house where it would shed the most light and create the most luminosity within the small buildings and homes in which they live. And then the gospel goes on to say, in the same way, your light must shine in the sight of men, so that seeing your good works, they may give praise to your Father in heaven. So he is comparing now the Christian witness to the light in the Palestinian home. It is to cast a glow, a luminosity, across the territory, the area where it exists, in order that the truth may be seen more clearly. And the benefit and the flavor and the preservation of the faith, which he talked about when it came to the salt, might be something that influences the world in which people live. He says that see your good works. And good works are an interesting thing in Matthew's gospel, because they refer more to a way of life than kind of the active public good works that were evident within the Hebrew society at the time of Jesus, and certainly at the time of Matthew writing his gospel as well. We know the example, and it comes to us in the readings from Ash Wednesday Masses, that the idea of ostentatiousness, the idea of demonstrativeness, when it comes to practicing good works, is not something that is pleasing to the Lord, nor is it something particularly effective in reflecting the presence of the glory of the Lord within the city, within the society in which they live. We know that there was a custom. If a person oftentimes was to pray, they would hire horn players to come and blow horns on the counter, on the corner, so that everybody could see them. Everybody could then see them giving alms to the poor or saying their prayers. And in the Gospels, it says, you know, they've already received their reward. They've gotten all the adulation of the locals. And if that's what it's all about, then it doesn't mean very much at all, because it doesn't point beyond the self, which is the big thing. It doesn't point beyond the self. Our good works are supposed to point beyond ourselves, and so that people give praise to our Father in heaven. They are supposed to be done for the greater glory of God, and not for our own prestige, our own position, our own kind of reputation in the local community. So the good works are a very specific thing in the role of the witnesses in the gospel. They are not demonstrative. They are not something that call attention to ourselves. They are something that are done quietly and authentically within the heart of the person. And those people who are beneficiaries of that witness, or those people who live in the presence of that witness, oftentimes then are drawn to give praise to our Father in heaven. How many times does an authentic Christian witness very honestly make people who are not necessarily zealous, or not even perhaps believers, be able to say, you know, I wonder what makes that person so kind. I wonder what makes that person so generous. I wonder what makes that person do what they do. They understand that it's more than a personality trait, And it does. It leads them then to ask the deeper questions about the meaning of the person's life and the motivations that that person has in the life that they live. So basically then, this gospel is summed up in an analysis of witness, an analysis of what it means to be a witness to the Lord in the midst of the world. I think that this becomes, we talk of witness is also in relationship to discipleship. There's a very interesting small book written by Hans-Urs von Balthasar called The Moment of Christian Witness, in which it goes through and it says that in every life there is some kind of what he calls an Ernstfall, some kind of emergency of faith, which at that moment a person must decide whether to testify to the Lord or not testify to the Lord, to witness to the Lord or not witness to the Lord. And I think that in our own lives, at least as we approach, you know, the ends of those lives sometimes, we can look back and see those moments in our lives when it was either when we had the opportunity to say yes or no to faith in Jesus Christ. And that at those moments were just kind of life-altering things for us. They were just automatically times when our lives were changed. And not maybe in dramatic expressions of ecstasy or any of things like that, but just deep within our hearts kind of changed our perspective on who we were in the world and what our role was in the world and what we were to do in the world. And those moments, von Balthasar says, are the times really when the witness, when the discipleship is sealed in our lives and sealed in a very important way in the lives of those who are the beneficiaries of that witness. Actually, his book was originally in German called Cordula, and it was about the Saint Cordula, which was kind of, there is, the story of Saint Ursula has historical truth in it, that she and some of her companions obviously were murdered by the Huns for resisting their violations. But at the same time, legend grew, and it was Ursula and her 11,000 virgins. And one of them, as the Huns were destroying them, hid in the rocks and was spared. But when she realized that the others had given their life for Christ, and she alone was left, she stood up and offered herself too as a witness to the Huns of the power and the saving grace of Jesus Christ. So it's a dramatic story, but a story that is useful as kind of a platform from von Balthasar to analyze the whole nature of witness, the whole nature of discipleship. In our own lives, we ourselves are called to, in many ways, oftentimes, and usually less dramatic ways, to seal our witness to Jesus Christ. And it's interesting how many times a good Catholic will kind of be crestfallen because they did have an opportunity to witness and they let it pass, in which case in that moment the salt had lost its flavor and the light had gone dim. That doesn't mean that that's the whole story of their life at all, but it means there are moments in our lives when those things do happen and when it calls us back to account for ourselves and hopefully calls us into the confessional in order to restart our lives and readjust our priorities and reaffirm our faith and our devotion to Jesus Christ. There is another thing, too, in this whole story of the light of the world. It's a fascinating reality, and it's something I think that in some ways should give us hope, actually, and give us consolation in the fact that we are not ourselves the source of the light. It is because that we are in some way, shape, or form open to the presence of Jesus Christ within us that witness is possible, has meaning, takes place, and is salvific. The whole story of light in the role of Christianity is a very dramatic story, and one which has all sorts of implications to it, all the way from the book of Genesis into the prologue of John, into the early, for instance, when we see the canticle of Simeon, that he declares the child in the temple as the light of the nations. And what does that mean? We tend to see that just kind of like, I don't know, light is always extrinsic to us, I suppose. And so we say the light of the nations at the Easter Vigil, at the dawn of creation. We light the Paschal candle that in the darkness, and Simeon says this to a land, or that Isaiah says this, a land that dwelt in darkness has seen a great light. So the pre-Christian world, the world without the presence of Christ, was considered to be a darkness, and into that darkness comes the light of Christ. But what is that light of Christ? And what is it that we have within us that is really powerful inside of ourselves, powerful in our souls, in our minds, in our hearts? It is, no matter which one of the traditional philosophies or theologies we want to accept, there is in some way, shape, or form an equation between light and grace. And there is also an equation, therefore, of a form of illumination in every kind of knowledge that we have. Because whether we call it in the theology of Augustine or Bonaventure as illumination, or whether we call it the grace informing the intellect in Thomas, it all comes out that in some way, shape, or form, the illumination of Jesus Christ is what makes the whole created order reasonable, knowable, deeper than its own surface, and extending far into the cosmos and far into time and space. We find in the book of Genesis, for instance, that God creates everything, except in the very beginning he does not create light. He speaks the word light, and there is light in the created order. John interprets that first chapter of Genesis, and he says to us, in the beginning was the Word was with God, the Word was God. And the Word was through which anything, and it was through the Word that everything came to be, and without him, nothing that is could be. And then he goes on to say, and the Word was the light of the world. And then he says, the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us. Light, therefore, became an identifiable reality with the Word. And so in the High Middle Ages, as the sciences began to develop, especially the science of physics, there was an understanding of the substructure of the entire universe being composed of light and of energy. This was especially true through the work of Robert Grosseteste at Oxford University. So that they understood light and energy become the foundation of the created order. But for them, light from revelation was, in Genesis it was Word, in John it was Word that became flesh. And so it was identifiable with the Christ, with the second person of the Blessed Trinity. It says, therefore, that light, that Christ is the foundation of all reality. It is the platform, we might say, upon which reality emerges and which the created order emerges. And without that platform, such a thing could have never happened. What this really means, then, is deep within the created order, and we know this now, actually, interesting, through the work of Einstein and now into the quantum physics work, that this affirmation of the foundation of the world being light and energy is reaffirmed. Light, be it wave or particle, is in some way, shape, or form an inherent and integral part of the very existence of the cosmos. Something which led Zachary Hayes to affirm that Bonaventure saw the cosmos as a glimpse at the consciousness of God. If that's true, and if the light is the foundation of all existent beings, then we too have a foundation in light. And that when that light is acknowledged, and when that light is liberated, such as not put under a tub, not put under some kind of cultural or personal obstacle which blocks it from shining in the world, but when we become instead vehicles for the emergence of that light, for that emergence of the underlying presence of Christ in all things, then we somehow or other free our souls from its own darkness. And when that light emerges, then it is in our good works. It is in our good works, understanding as witness and not as show, which then flavors that light and interprets it and identifies it and brings it into a conceivable and understandable presence in the midst of the world. So the witness of the Christian is not just a good idea. The witness of the Christian is not just, see what a good boy I am. The witness of the Christian is the opening up of the inner self to the enduring presence of Jesus Christ in the midst of creation, in the midst of the world, in the midst of ourselves. And it allows it, therefore, to shine forth into the world where it is preserved and flavored by how a Christian lives and what a Christian does. While this might be a highly hypothetical, it is certainly very much alive in the interior castles of St. Teresa. And it is very, very much alive also in all of the idea that somehow or other, through the Rhineland mystics, Jan van Riebeeck and others, that the Trinity dwells within, which means the light dwells within, and that light illuminates from within the life, the activity, and the person who allows it to flow freely into their hearts, their souls, and their minds. It is a source of wisdom, it is a source of truth, it is a source of goodness, it is a source of interior beauty. It is, therefore, in fact, as we said, the platform of the Christian life, the platform which is Jesus Christ, through which all things come to be, and which shine forth into the world, preserved and flavored by the life of the Christian witness, the life of the Christian disciple. Let us ask the Lord to allow that light to flow freely through us, to remove the obstacles we place in our hearts and souls by sin, by ignorance, by malice, and allow Jesus Christ to shine through, as so that Christianity does become a city built on a hill, a city where the lamp is raised up so that it may give light to all. Christ is with us, among us, and within us. Let him be free to save the world.
Foundations in Faith is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of Foundations in Faith are available at stgabrielradio.com.
Veni, Sancte.